Welcome back, everyone. This is Austin Roberts. Here at the Ecosiv Podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and just world.
Hello, everyone. We welcome you to our third discussion highlighting Jainism and the ecological mindset in the context of the Dharma traditions. My name is Juliana Arnold, and I lead the Ecological Mindset Project here at the Institute for Ecological Civilization. You can find us at ecosiv.org. A big thanks today to our sponsor, Dr. Jasvant Modi and Christopher Miller with the Arihanta Academy. Our Ecological Mindset Project aims to launch a movement on ecology and the Dharma traditions across North America, with a focus on the Jain Dharma concept of ahimsa or nonviolence. We recognize that to successfully address the growing ecological crisis, we need a shift in human consciousness. That is a shift towards an ecological mindset. We will meet with distinguished scholars in the Dharma traditions to discuss the interconnectedness between Dharma traditions and ecological processes, and to highlight how Jain Dharma represents a fundamentally ecological way of life. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Shivani Bhotra, for a discussion on Jainism, ecology, and the environment. Dr. Shivani Bhotra is an assistant professor in the Department of Religious Studies at California State University, Long Beach. She was recently the Bhagwan Mahavira Prakrit Fellow for the program of the International School for Jain Studies. Before this, she worked as a postdoctoral researcher at Rice University in Houston, Texas. She has also served as a lecturer in religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her focus is South Asian traditions, Jainism, and nonviolence. Her research explores the role of religious education for children as a means of preserving Jain values and culture for future generations. Dr. Bhotra's pedagogical interests include Jain yoga, nonviolence, environment, foodways, and integration of the local Jain community into her pedagogy with field trips. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this rich and deliberate discussion with us today, Shivani. First, I wanted to ask just a few questions briefly about Jainism and the Dharma traditions. So our first question is going to be looking at, for those who are not familiar with Jainism, could you please begin by offering us a brief overview of some of the traditional Jain beliefs and practices?
Thank you, Juliana, for this initiative and for your kind introduction. You know, you make me feel, wow, I have done all that.
Oh,
so... Jainism is an ancient tradition from India, and Jains believe that their tradition is pre-Vedic or pre-Aryan, so it's difficult to actually say how old the tradition is. But let us say, let us think about the Vedic times and see that the two streams of traditions have always, you know, been within the corpus of Indian religions. Vedic traditions and Shramanic movement or Shramanic traditions. So the Vedic traditions have culminated into what we today understand as Hinduism or Hindu tradition, Hindu religions, whether it is the Shaiv or the Vaishnavs or the goddesses. And the Shramanic movements also had number of different traditions, but what is most practiced in today's time is Jainism and Buddhism. These have been the Shramanic traditions. Now, because they all come from Indian traditions, there are a lot of similarities that, you know, there are between these, and there are a lot of differences also. But today we see that Jainism, even though it's a small, it's a minority tradition, and small in the from the perspective of population, Jains are small in number in India. But from the perspective of their influence, they are socially, economically, and culturally very vibrant. They have contributed a lot to the, you know, different landscapes of Indian architecture, food, and of course, you know, will gradually come into the different Jain principles or tenets. But overall, we can say that, you know, Jains have contributed to the Indian, you know, panorama of religions very richly. And it's a vibrant community in a small but vibrant community in India. And gradually, it is also the diaspora community is also gaining momentum and, you know, representing themselves strongly outside of India.
That's amazing. Thank you for doing that. And next, you kind of briefly talked about this, but could you compare and contrast the Jain beliefs and practices with those of the Dharma tradition, such as Hinduism, Buddhism, and Sikhism.
Sure. So if we think of Hinduism, Buddhism, or Sikhism, we actually know that since all these traditions came from India, the origin is India, they believe in the concept of nonviolence or ahimsa. It's not exclusive to the Jains. The idea of rebirth or samsara, the idea of karma theory, and the idea of enlightenment, you know, the separation of the body and to reach the highest epitome of, you know, happiness. So all these traditions do accept these tenets. But the way Jains have explained and gone in depth with ahimsa is different from the way Hindus have done or Sikhs or Buddhists have done. For example, let us see the example of karma theory. It's a very understood and accepted concept that so as you do, so shall you reap. Your actions bear consequences, and what consequences we have, what fruits we are experiencing in our lives, good or bad, our consequences are determined by our past karmas, right? For example, all the traditions from India will say that if you sow a plant of bitter gourd and you keep watering it and you keep praying to it, oh, I'm waiting for the sweet mangoes to come. Oh, I'm waiting for the sweet mangoes to come. You keep nurturing the plants, you keep watering the plants with the thought of you will get the fruits of sweet mangoes. After a point when seasons change and the seed grows into a plant, into a tree, and what you get is bitter gourd. And you are so disappointed. The whole 3 years I have been praying and wanting and hoping and contemplating on getting mango fruit. Why did I get bitter gourd? Because the seed itself was of bitter gourd. So Indian traditions say that the results and the fruits that we get is what we have done in the past. Our past actions determine our fruits, right? If you sow a mango plant, a mango seed, then you get mango fruit. But Jains take this whole idea of karma a step beyond this idea and say, according to Jains, karma is a fine material. It's a matter. It's a property. It's something which is so subtle and so minute that it clings to the soul. And it's only through penance you can, you know, detach yourself with the karma. So according to, it's only Jains, neither Hindus nor Buddhists or Sikhs consider karma to be a material property, a particle. According to Jains, it is such a tiny indivisible part of the matter that it cannot be seen, but it can be, it has, you know, all the properties of material of an object. So this is how, you know, this is one way where they differ. Of course, you know, we can go on talking about the differences between Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, and Sikhs, but the overall idea is that. And there is another place where Jains stand out and differ from Hindus, Buddhists, and Sikhs is in their concept of Anekantvad. So according to Anekantvad, you know, truth is multifaceted, and it can be seen from multiple perspectives. And this truth can be only seen and understood by enlightened beings who have attained complete knowledge. Humans with their incomplete knowledge cannot look at all the aspects of truth in one go. So just to make this complex, doctrine simplified, let's take one example. According to Hindus, this universe is eternal. It is Nityavad, unchanging, eternal. According to Buddhists, the universe is anitya, non-eternal. It keeps changing all the time. So according to Jains, these are ekantic views. These are single viewpoints. So they are considered to be extremist, extreme points of view, right? Hindus insist that the universe is eternal. That is one extreme viewpoint. Buddhists insist that this universe is non-eternal. That's another extreme point. Jains say that from the perspective of, from the standpoint of substance, the universe is eternal. But from the perspective of mode, things change. So it is also non-eternal. So this example is very beautifully presented in one of the Jain scriptures called Bhagavati Sutra, where Mahavira and his most immediate disciple Indrabhuti Gautam asks Mahavira's question. Gautam says, Mahavir, O Lord, the Venerable One, what is universe? Mahavir responds, the universe is eternal. Indrabhuti Gautam again asks, what is the universe? Mahavir says, the universe is non-eternal. Now Indrabhuti Gautam gets confused. He again asks, what is the universe? This is, narrating from the scriptures, Bhagavati Sutra. So Mahavira says, the universe is eternal and non-eternal. And that's when he starts to clarifying that, from the qualification of, substance, it does not change. And from the perspective of modes, it changes. So Jains say that we cannot have a dogmatic perspective, but we have to look at any material, any object, or any viewpoint from different perspectives in order to derive upon the real truth.
Wow. I can imagine just how much your students love you. Just based off of that, I learned so much myself. So thank you so much for that. That was awesome. I just wanted to get to know you a little bit as a person, as a scholar, and understand your interests within the field. So what was it about Jain philosophy that drew your interest initially?
That's again a very interesting question, Juliana. I grew up in a Jain family, but I grew up in a cosmopolitan city, Kolkata, where I was really mixing up with all kinds of people. So I didn't grow up with a Jain understanding or exposure to Jain principles or tenets. But much later on, two decades after, as an adult, when I started living in a city called Jaipur, which was also called a Jain Puri and a Dharampuri, a land of religions, my first exposure, the real exposure to Jainism, started much later in my life as an adult. And that's what, kind of qualifies me to be a professor also, because I now look at Jainism more objectively, as I didn't grow up with that whole, dogmas or rituals or practices. So what really drew my attention was monks and nuns. I simply loved their simple minimalistic lifestyle. I was attracted to their, white, garments, their robes. I was attracted to their simplicity in explaining scriptures. I was attracted to their, walking barefoot. I then started my initial experience of Jainism was walking barefoot with those monks and nuns. And during those walks, we got to discuss Ahimsa, Karma theory, and they have always explained these doctrines through stories, through narratives in much simpler language, and with as simplicity as their lifestyle represents.
Awesome. So, then what parts of the Jain philosophy do you practice in your daily life?
I try. But because I'm living outside of India, it's very difficult to control one's carbon footprint because family is back home in India. But nevertheless, one thing is very strongly and distinctively of the Jains is the two streams of Mahavrat, called great vows for monks and nuns to practice, and Anuvrat, called small vows for the lay community to practice. So all these vows are same. The five vows that monks and nuns practice are just the same as lay community, like people like us practice. But the intensity varies. And that's why they are called great vows and small vows. While monks and nuns practice them rigorously to the highest degree, lay community, every individual has the flexibility to chart their own vow system. And that could be different from me or my brother, me or my mother, me or my husband. So for example, like you decide to have just two garments, two pair of garments, one bag or a few shoes, or, you know, and you think that you can live very comfortably with those belongings, right? But for me, I might think, no, two is too less for me. I should at least have five. I should at least have two bags. I should at least have three pairs of shoes. I should at least have this. I should at least have that. Still, you know, I live within a certain constraint. So when I go to the market, I will not be lured by stuff all the time, because I know that, you know, I have five pair of, you know, trousers or, you know, garments. So this whole flexibility that, you know, I can practice the religion according to my needs, not according to the doctrines, not according to what the scriptures say, not according to what the monks have said, because the monks give you the idea, the scriptures, Jain teachers explain you the concept of limiting possessions. Don't they explain you that, you know, the word Jain comes from the term Jina, and Jina are those who have conquered. So the Jain preceptors, the 24 Tirthankaras, are Jinas, and they have conquered. What have they conquered? Not lands, not territories. They have conquered their negative passion. And there are four negative passions: anger, greed, ego, and deceit. So this is one of the first teachings of Jainism, that to understand the whole word Jina, which means, you know, conquerors, something who has won, something that has, you know, overtaken. But here it is not taking away someone's house or some state. It is just inner turmoil, fighting from your inner negative passions, inner, you know, purifying and transforming your inner self. And one of the four negative passions is greed. So they explain you that why greed, and we today we know what is the, you know, repercussion, what is the outcome, what has greed manifested into.
Wow.
So this is how I practice, by trying to be more, you know, vigilant about my consumerism, and the other thing that I do is that, which again I learned from Jain monks and nuns, is to practice samayik. So I know that I can't live a life filled with penance and austerities that a monk or nun are living in India, right? So within Jainism, there is a practice called samayik, called equanimity, you know, sitting for 48 minutes in a meditative posture. So samayik means to live in equanimity for those 48 minutes, while monks and nuns live in that state throughout their life. They don't take bath, they don't cook, they don't touch money, they don't use transportation. So they are living that high level of, you know, without minimum carbon footprint throughout their life. So I have my restraints. I don't have the willpower to live that lifestyle throughout my life. So at least for 48 minutes, I sit in a meditative posture by reciting a certain mantra. And for those 48 minutes, I refrain from eating food, from answering telephone calls, from answering emails, from, you know, walking or harming micro beings that we see in the environment. So it's a 48 minutes of meditation with a purpose. So at least for those 48 minutes, I try to live the life of a monk and nun if I do it truthfully.
Yeah.
If I sit for those 48 minutes in the name of samayik and my mind is running throughout this, across different oceans, then, you know, it serves the purpose. But at least, you know, it's an attempt, it's a starting, it's a beginning that I'm able to sit for 48 minutes without moving.
Yeah.
So
is
this
there
is
a reason why it's 48 minutes? Is it
There are a lot of calculations and logic behind
Okay.
48 minutes, and there are scientific reasons also for 48 minutes that, human mind is not able to concentrate at a time beyond 48 minutes. So studies have shown, there is this 40, magic number 48 is what, just like why the 24 Tirthankaras, 24 Jinnas in one time cycle, why every time you find one magical number, 24, 48,
Right.
or
Wow.
8.4 million species.
Yeah. It's amazing that you really formulate your own practice within such a consumerist society. I really commend you on that because I can only imagine it must be kind of difficult, especially in the United States. So.
Yes, it takes time to practice, and otherwise it's not difficult. If you sit with your digital asset, which sit with your iPad, you don't even realize 1 hour you were just sitting and watching.
True.
And
Yeah.
here we are you to sit for 48 minutes.
Right. That's true.
So.
So, the next question, I know we had talked previously. I really am curious to know your perspective is, as a woman, what elements of Jainism do you believe uplift women, and how does it support the feminist movement?
Here, Juliana, I would say that I not say that I don't like the word uplift, but I have an objection to the term uplift, because
Yeah.
uplift is a term we use and when we really want to lift something, higher. Women in Jainism have had a wonderful position right from the beginning. The first Tirthankar, Rishabhnath, had 100 sons and 2 daughters, Brahmi and Sundari. So he taught writing script to Brahmi and he taught mathematics to Sundari. So it is said that he taught his daughters 72 different skills. And Rishabhnath is considered to be, his time frame is considered by Jain teachers to be millions of years ago. So, and Jains do get up with this, singing and chanting this devotional song in which they revere 16 virtuous women. So on the one hand, there are Tirthankars who are male figures, who are revered, human, who were humans but have become, revered jinnas who have conquered their negative passions. On the other hand, Jains also have expressed devotion for these 16 virtuous women who have attained high level of, spirituality. They have gone much higher in their practice that they are revered even today. And these women are all from antiquity, from history, from the times of different Tirthankaras. So this is one side of it. So women have had a lot of influence. Women, nuns were very influential. Lay women have also had, been very influential in different periods of time within the Jain community, within the Jain tradition, right? But over a period of time, if we look at, if we just go little beyond our current time, we will see that, there has been a lot of cultural influences, lot of social influences and pressures that we get a kind of discursive image about women because we consider their roles to be subordinate. We consider that they have been not treated fairly, right?
Right.
These are more recent developments, but here I would like to quote that women have been treated very fairly and their status is up, is it has been quite high right from the beginning within the Jain tradition. Jains also revere a lot the mothers of Tirthankaras who are women figures. So these are just a few examples, but I would like to quote from a 20th century monk leader, Shvetambar monk leader Acharya Tulsi. So he in one of his interviews, he said that, he acknowledges the active feminist movements in the West. His view is that women should have equal rights as men is kind of gaining strength because it is influenced by the Western societies. Now, these are, he says, are ripples of Western movements that are also observed in India. But he also says, he states that women's development, he takes women's development in a different direction. He says that women's progress in the society should not be measured by men's progress. as man has not reached the pinnacle of all developments. He has not progressed in the real sense, and in many ways, a man still lags behind. Thus, women should not idealize men, and women should now start to think independently regarding her own status in the society, given equal opportunity to character development. This is what, you know, Acharya Tulsi says, that character development is important, and any kind of material progress in the society is one aspect of it. So women should think more independently and not measure its growth or its success or, you know, because through men.
That's awesome. I think that grants women quite a bit of autonomy from the beginning, which is fantastic. Wow. It's very different, I think. It's like in the West, we've expected women to kind of need it to be lifted up to the status of man in a way, while in Jain tradition, women have already led those roles, but potential Western thought has kind of made them believe that women are kind of lesser than men. So they have to rise up, which in reality, they never had to in the first place.
Yeah, Western thought and a lot of other influences in the society, because different periods of time, society undergoes different changes. There are social pressures, cultural pressures, there are things that have changed from the past. So people, that's why, you know, history is important. And that's why I always, you know, and I always think, I regard myself as an ethno-historical historian, because I'm an ethnographer by, you know, choice. And I always look at old phenomena, you know, what lay people used to practice during the period of Mahavir, what influenced those practices over a period of time, how those practices have changed, what has influenced those changes. So my current research is about, you know, change in religious education. Right. And as your questions come, I will talk more about it.
Great. Next, I kind of just wanted to shift the conversation a little bit, looking specifically at that relationship between Jainism and the environment. In this podcast series, we are exploring connections between the beliefs and practices of Jainism and what many today are calling the ecological mindset. Do you think that this is a valid parallel? And how would you describe those similarities?
That's a very interesting question. And in fact, that is the heart of the thing that your organization is into. So again, you know, from a Jain perspective, I would say that, you know, for Jains, ecology or environment is not just to see that everything is beautiful, you know, the trees are trimmed and well taken care of. It's not that. It's not about, you know, taking care of endangered species and things. It is basically about responsibility. That when you talk about, you know, no harm, it is your duty not to harm. It's not your duty to save or protect. When do you save and protect? When someone has harmed. So your focus should be on transmitting the value of not harming. And like, you know, humans have different mindsets, as you rightly put in your question. To answer this question, I will narrate a story that we have heard from, you know, a long time, again, through monks and nuns. And this story also appears in a text called Avashyak Churni, the second part of Avashyak Churni. So there are six travelers who lost their way and they land up into a forest. And because they lost their way, they were very hungry and they were looking for food. They happened to come across a tree laden with fruits. And traveler number one says, oh, this tree has so many fruits, let's cut the trunk. And he picks up an axe. The second traveler say, no, wait a minute, we don't need to uproot the tree by cutting the trunk, let us cut the branches. The third traveler says, we don't even need to cut the branches, let us only cut those twigs that have fruits. The fourth traveler says, no, we don't even need to cut the twigs. Let us just pluck the fruits. The fifth traveler says, let us only pluck ripe fruits. What is the point of plucking all the fruits. And the sixth traveler says, wait a minute, we don't even need to pluck any fruit from the tree. There are so many fruits already fallen down. They are ripe. It's enough to fill our hunger, to quench our hunger. So these six people, you know, symbolically represent different mindsets.
Yeah.
Whether you want to cut the trunk or you just want to pick fruits on the ground.
Right.
What we are doing, you know, as human beings, what we are doing, we are actually cutting the branch on which we are sitting. We don't realize that. And then we put a lot of effort in trying to protect the environment, trying to save the animals, trying to, you know, create shelters. But the whole idea is to transform your thinking, your mindset, your psychology. And that can only come through, you know, experience, through education, through training in nonviolence. So this is just through an example, we can understand the whole environmental crisis and how our connection with the environment is more about cleansing our inner thoughts.
Wow. That's a very powerful story. Thank you for sharing that with me. I really appreciate that. How do you think that Jain philosophy could contribute or already has contributed to the environmental movement today?
There are vows within the Jain tradition that one shouldn't cut trees.
Okay.
So instead, you know, people take this vow that I will not cut trees. People in Jainism, you know, there has been a movement called the Anuvrat movement, which was again started by the 20th century monk, a Shvetambar monk called Acharya Tulsi, in which he lays down 11 different vows for the lay community. And this movement is made to include Jains and non-Jains equally. So the whole idea in the movement is that, you know, you will save water. So Jains do emphasize a lot about how precious water is. Not cutting trees is one thing. Not using excess water is another. Again, I will try to explain this through a story that I grew up listening to. Not just from a Jain perspective, but it is said by my grandmother again and again. And I know that she comes staunchly from a Jain perspective, that there were two women living in a household, and she was living with her father-in-law, husband, and children. One day, one woman was, you know, walking with a pot of water, and her leg tripped and she fell down. The pot of water fell down and the pot broke. The water spilled on the floor. So the father-in-law was extremely angry and annoyed with the daughter-in-law that you should have been careful. You should have been more mindful of your steps and not let the water go waste. After a few weeks or months, the same incident happened with her elder sister-in-law. And this time it wasn't a pot of water, but it was a pot of clarified butter, which is so precious and expensive. Not water, which is free, but butter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And mm-hmm. The pot fell, butter spilled on the floor. And father-in-law just told her that, you know, be careful, you know, you might hurt yourself. And seeing this, you know, difference of treatment, the younger daughter-in-law got very upset. And she took it by heart. She said that my father-in-law loves the elder sister-in-law. She broke a pot of butter and he just told her, be careful, did you get hurt? And he just doesn't like me. I broke only water, our pot of water. Water can be, you know, we can get the water back from the well. And he abused me, he yelled at me, he scolded me. So she gets so, so upset and it, to the extent that she falls ill. Doctors come to treat her, they give her medicines, but there is no cure. The father-in-law, the sister-in-law, and everyone is concerned about the health of this woman. And later on, you know, a wise doctor comes and he says that, why don't you all leave the room? Let me just talk to this, to my patient. After a conversation with the patient, this doctor figures out the problem is not a physical illness. It's a mental thought that has, you know, that has really grown into a problem which has manifested in her illness. So he talks about that problem to her father in to their father-in-law, and the father-in-law explains, it's not about me liking you more or the elder one more. It's not about partiality. Butter can be made again, but water is so precious. You have to learn to conserve this natural resource. So the whole story, the moral of the story is how important is natural resource. And we have to respect that. And in natural resource, water is so significant.
Wow.
So that's why, you know, there is what, according to Jains, there is life in water. One sensed life. And that's why monks and nuns do not take bath. There is they are very vigilant in their use of water. And so if you look at from that perspective, we can say that how environmentally close the tradition is, because they have valued water, they value natural resources, and their lifestyle does. Of course, there are exceptions everywhere. You will find Jain homes with a lot of splash of water, big lawns. But then again, you know, within that abundance, they know how to draw a line, and that is where Anurat comes in the scene. As I told you, your need could be 10 garments, my need could be 3 or 4, your need could be 15, my need could be 20, 25. But at least, you know, I save myself from the hundreds and thousands that's there out in the market.
That's awesome that your grandmother told you that story when you were younger. I bet it really unintentionally influenced your life and the way you interact with the environment, for sure. Well, thank you for sharing a little bit about the environmental movement and that push and link between Jainism and the environment. I wanted to talk a little bit and ask a few more personalized questions to you. First of all, what are some of the differences that you have noticed between Jain thought in the diaspora versus Jain thought or philosophy in India?
That's a wonderful question, Juliana. I think that, you know, that you have, your whole questioning is so deeply thinking from the perspective that I come from India, my research is in diaspora, so I'm able to see the two perspectives. So basically, there are a lot of differences, but I will point out three significant that, you know, we can understand at this time. But when we meet, we can discuss this question more in detail.
Sure.
So, first of all, you know, children in India, let me start with children, because my PhD research has been religious education, transmission of religious values to children or the next generation. So children in India are born in Jain families, right? So parents, they want their children to remain Jain. Because they are born in Jain families, they follow a Jain diet, and they also have their faith in Jainism. But children in diaspora, parents want their children to be educated Jains. So the question is not just that they are born in a Jain family and so they have to be a Jain. But the question is that since they are born in a Jain family, they want to preserve and, you know, preserve the tradition by transmitting it to the next generation in an educated way. So they want children to ask questions, to understand the principles, and to apply those principles in their daily life. And that can only happen once you understand and you are convinced about it. So this is a major difference that, you know, diaspora Jains want their children to be educated Jains. As by educated Jains, I don't mean just the mainstream of education, but, you know, education in understanding Jain values and implementing those Jain values. Mainstream education is common, you know, going to best of schools because is common for Jains in America or Jains in India. But here, educated Jains, I mean, you know, to familiarize yourself with Jain principles and Jain practices. And you can only do that by asking questions, by understanding. If you understand and then practice, then it remains with you. But if you just do because your parents did or your grandparents asked you to do, that means, you know, there is no assurity that it will always remain with you. Right. This is one important thing. The second important change is that, you know, there is a strong drive because Jain monks and nuns are in India. They are not in America. That's a big difference. In India, the community is complete with monk, nun, layman, and laywomen. But in America, you have sometimes, you know, traveling monks and nuns, but not all the time, not everywhere. So the whole desire for keeping the tradition alive, the whole desire for Jain practices and intensity is much stronger. American Jains now have a dream. Like Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. So I am kind of, you know, wording the dream of American Jains, educated American Jains. And their dream is to see Jainism in their homes, Jainism in their families, Jainism in across different universities. Just like how Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam are taught at, systematically in all world, acclaimed universities. They want to see Jainism also as a discipline, as a field of study with the same rigorousness and, you know, same kind of scrutiny, right? So this dream is an American Jain dream. To see Jainism grow, prosper, at university level. This dream is not in India. Third, and not the most important, but also a difference that needs to be, you know, shared, is Indian Jains, it's very difficult for them to accept being vegan because American Jains are more towards veganism. In the States, the dairy industry is supposedly more violent, and the whole drive of being vegan is strong here among American Jains. But since dairy has been a cultural component in India and a very important aspect of food item, and it's also very difficult to get substitutes or non-dairy equivalent of, you know, things in India. And monks and nuns will only accept food that has been offered to them. So if families don't practice being non-dairy or, you know, being vegan, then they can't offer the food to monks and nuns. So basically, Indian Jains communities are, you know, vegetarian, but they might closely stick to a strict Jain diet by not taking rooted vegetables.
Yeah.
Whereas American or diaspora Jain community is more bending towards veganism, even though they might not follow a strict Jain diet, they might accept the rooted vegetables in their diet, you know, more frequently. Sure. So these are some of the differences.
That's so fascinating. My family, they're Seventh-day Adventists. I don't know if you've heard of that religion, but they also are primarily vegetarians. And so that's interesting because I was vegan for a very long time and then I ended up going to Switzerland for university. Obviously, it's the land of cheese, so I could no longer be vegan, but that's an interesting... I never really thought about the idea of there not being as many substitutes within India, but in the United States, it's very prevalent and it's kind of a fad right now to become vegan, right? So that makes sense. That makes sense why that would be a difference for sure.
So,
yeah. Lastly, about this idea of Jainism and social justice, I just wanted to ask a question. How do you think that social justice plays a role in the contemporary environmental movement? Is there a Jain philosophy of justice? If so, is it like or unlike contemporary language used about justice?
So, you know, it's a very interesting question. Now, when you are asking this, I'm thinking that we are planning this conference on... in April, and the conference title is Sum of Saran, the assembly of Tirthankaras. Some of Saran, the assembly of Tirthankaras, non-violence and environment in Jainism, right?
Yeah.
So now when you are saying this question, I'm rethinking about the title. I should say some of Saran. And, you know, the word some of Saran itself is, a literal translation is called assembly of preaching. It's a hall, it's a construction in a circular form, where there are 12 different circles, different rows like, where Tirthankar sits in the center of the circle, and there are and he's facing all sides, right?
Yeah.
And around him are a first circle will be his immediate disciples, then will be, you know, kings and queens, then will be lay people, then will be, so it is, there are 12 different circles and all forms of species, whether they are celestial or they are, you know, small species or animals are included in this system. So language that the Tirthankara uses is comprehended according to the species. So it's not that, you know, if I speak in English, only people who understand English will comprehend, will understand.
So if we wanted to go back to that idea of justice within Jain philosophy, is there a Jain philosophy of justice? And if so, is it similar or not as similar to that of contemporary language surrounding justice ideals?
I think, you know, this is a great question, because right as you are saying this question, I'm rethinking about about the conference that we are planning in April to add this word social justice, because the theme of the conference is Sum of Saran, an assembly of Tirthankars, nonviolence and environment in Jainism is the punchline. So we in conceptualizing this conference and the theme, we considered Sum of Saran to be an ideal platform, a structure which has 12 layers in circular form, where the Tirthankar or the preacher, regardless of the first Tirthankar Rishabh or the 23rd or the 24th, any Tirthankar who has attained the highest form of knowledge has the authority to preach. So when he preaches, in these 12 layers of, you know, circles, people across different regions, across different, you know, gender, across different species, whether they are gods from celestial beings or they are animals or they are human beings, they have a space for themselves. So there is, that's the whole equality is considered here, that there is no segregation. You know, everyone is included in this preaching hall, and everyone has the right to the teachings and preachings of the learned, you know, hermit or saint or Tirthankara. So in a way, if we look at back from the history of Jainism, we see this important social component or concept of social justice, which is so much embedded into the structure of Sum of Saran. And so here, no one is excluded. Women have the right to listen to the teachings. Men have the right. Gods have the right. Animals have the right. So if we look at pictures of, you know, those scriptures, you know, ancient depiction of those, you know, writings, we see many pictures of Sum of Saran and those 12 circles and how people are, you know, flocking in there. And everyone, and Tirthankar speaks in a language that is comprehensible according to your, you know, species.
Right.
So this is one aspect of social justice that I consider is, even though, you know, it is goes way behind back in history or 2600 years ago back in the times of Mahavira, but it's very difficult to even conceptualize that kind of a structure in today's time, you know, where unless we look at a digital platform.
Right. That makes sense. That's awesome. I wanted to end our beautiful discussion with one final question. If Jain principles were implemented in a society, what do you think would look different than many of the societies around us today? And is there one or two principles of Jain philosophy you hope to see implemented today in this world?
That's again a great question, Juliana. I feel that, you know, the three principles that, you know, Jainism really has been talking about in context to the present contemporary society, whether in India or outside, and especially, you know, American Jains have really taken these three concepts and discussed a lot about it. We have books on 3AAA, these three concepts, which I would say is Ahimsa, Anekantvad, and Aparigraha. These three are the values from a Jain perspective. I would say that, you know, we can really embrace them. Ahimsa, by not harming. Not harming doesn't mean just be a vegetarian. Not harming doesn't mean just not harming by your thought, speech, and action. Not harming actually means that, you know, not killing, not, you know, being rude, not accepting something which is injustice. Not injustice can also be, you know, if someone is accumulating a lot, and if there are people we know that really there is so much of inequality. So how one can, by embracing the concept of aparigraha. Aparigraha is a beautiful concept, again, that comes from Indian traditions. And it doesn't just mean that no possession or just being absolutely without any things. It is actually the concept where your attachment toward possession has to minimize. I can have 100 pair of, you know, trousers, or I can have 3 computers in my office. But the whole I and my and mine and that whole spirit of belonging, that this is mine, according to Jains, you know, if that reduces, then we solve a lot of the world problems. Again, Anekantvad, here I would like to bring back the concept of Anekantvad, that if we are non-dogmatic about our own perspective, if we have the openness to respect and listen to the other's perspective, then we can resolve a lot of world problems. And we are always, you know, trying to feed conquering lands, conquering people, conquering, you know, territories or houses or, you know, other physical things. But how we can, through meditation, internally cleanse oneself and try to conquer our own negative passions. If they are cleansed, then, you know, it will definitely show in your whole approach to the material world. If your internal world is cleansed, then it will reflect on your external world.
Absolutely. Wow. I feel like throughout this discussion, not only have I learned so much, but it's really made me reflect on my own upbringing and the society in which I am, you know, around every single day. And it really opens my eyes to this idea that you've described, that there's not just one perspective. There's so many that we really need to take into account. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. It has been my privilege, Dr. Bothra, to have you participate today in this dialogue. It has been such a rich discussion. And like I've said, I've just learned so much myself. If you want to learn more about Jainism and the environment, make sure to tune into our in-person conference that Shivani has been vigorously planning, and we'll be hosting in April during Earth Day weekend. We'll make sure to have more details about the conference closer to its date. Thank you so much, Anne. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Juliana. It was really my pleasure to talk and to be here and to, you know, just share a few things about the tradition that I'm passionate about, and I love to teach my students. I have a good group of students.
I'm so glad.
I'm so glad to be here at Cal State Long Beach. It's a wonderful university and a city.
Amazing. We encourage you to join us more via our social media platforms, whether that be Instagram, Facebook, X, or Twitter, and LinkedIn. And yeah, I hope you have a lovely rest of your day, rest of your evening, and yeah, just make sure to tune in for more. Thank you.